Welcome to For Better or Worse, How Today's Technology Has Changed Families' Lives. My name is Sarah Dimmerman, also known as Help Me Sarah, and today I'm in conversation with Mark Saltzman. Mark is one of North America's most recognizable and trusted tech experts, specializing in consumer electronics, internet trends, and interactive entertainment. He has authored 15 books since 1996, and currently contributes to nearly 50 high-profile publications in North America. Mark also hosts various video segments, including Gear Guide, which can be seen at Cineplex movie theaters and sister chains across Canada. And he's a regular guest on CNN, CNN International, and CTV's Canada AM. Mark also hosts Tech Talk, which is a syndicated radio spot across Canada. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks for having me, Sarah.
So I'd like to begin by asking, since you're the tech expert, how have you seen technology evolve over the past, let's say, decade, but it could be even more recent than that?
Wow. So it's evolved. The growth in which it has evolved has been so accelerated over the past couple of decades, especially over the last decade. It's amazing to see, as someone who covers this space, daily, it's amazing the amount of innovation and, technology that has evolved. So it's number one, it's the speed at which it has evolved has accelerated. For better or for worse, it can be overwhelming.
Right.
For those who are trying to grapple with technology, but for someone like me, a geek at heart, I love it.
How did you actually?
It also has become a lot more pervasive. I mean, I think on a day-to-day, our day-to-day lives are becoming increasingly reliant on technology, again, for better or for worse.
Well, I say that my 13-year-old has a prosthetic prosthetic kind of attachment to her to her hand, because quite literally, I don't remember the last time that I didn't see her with her cell phone in her hand.
A lot of this innovation that I'm speaking of, it has happened in the mobility department. So we're now, in our pocket or in our purse, we have more technology crammed into that one little device than we saw on computers for decades.
Yeah.
Saw in computers for decades. I mean, it's amazing. Your smartphone it is, for all intents and purposes, a digital Swiss Army knife.
Yeah.
It's a computer, it's your web browser, it's your messaging solution, it's a gaming device, it's a camera, it's a camcorder, it's a GPS navigation tool, can help you, track your fitness and your weight loss. It can help you scan products at retail to tell you when there's a better deal.
Yeah.
It's amazing these devices can do. It's scary fast it has evolved for, an industry that's, about 10 years old and started by BlackBerry.
A friend of mine even showed me recently an app that helps her find her car in a parking lot.
That's right. Yeah, I've written about those as well. When you step out of your car, it uses GPS technology to geo-stamp, if you will, your geographical location. And you can also add a note like, B1 or what have you, or even take a picture of the spot. So then when you leave, say, the mall or the wherever you are, where it's a big parking lot, you just launch the app and it'll give you turn-by-turn directions to get back to your car.
Amazing.
So on one hand, technology is still what it was decades ago. It's a tool that is meant to help us remain more productive and efficient and, to help us give us information and to entertain us and to help us communicate with those who matter wherever life takes us. So the goal, the purpose of technology is still the same, but it's just becoming a lot more accessible. It's getting a lot more portable and a lot more powerful.
So when we talk technology, we're talking, as you said, mobile devices. We're also talking, are we talking television? Are we talking, stationary products? I guess we're talking about everything, right?
We are. I think much of the innovation over the past decade has happened in the mobile space. Computers, naturally, they get faster and more powerful. Then we start seeing different form factors. We saw over the last decade the laptop eclipse the desktop as the primary device, basically untethering yourself from the wall. So they're getting smaller without any sacrifices. They're just as powerful as a desktop in most cases. Plus, you've got the added convenience of wireless connectivity. So you not only get high-speed internet as you did on your desktop, but now you can be anywhere in and or around your home or even out on a park bench or on a moving bus on the way to work or train, and you still can get that kind of speed. So much of the innovation has happened in the mobile computing space, i.e. smartphones and apps, tablets. But we've also seen innovations, of course, in television. Over the past decade, we've seen our television and broadcasts and movies go from standard definition to high definition and soon 4K or ultra high definition, adding more clarity. But I think really that the big buzz is what's happening, you know, in our pockets is these smartphones.
And so are there specific technological items that you know of being particularly appealing to children, for example, say like under 13, so preteen?
So, you know, I'll stop short of recommending smartphones for that age group, even though we're starting to see, you know, like my kids, I have three kids. I have twin 10-year-olds and an 8-year-old, and my twins in grade 5, they're in the minority for not having a smartphone.
And that's amazing with a dad who's so...
I know. Well, I'm a firm believer in moderation and balance, and they have so much of it in the home that I don't think they need it out of the home. And I think it also depends. I'm not passing judgment on parents who decide to give their kids a smartphone because every situation is different.
Right.
There's a lot of busy dual-income families who have to leave their kids you know, alone or with a caregiver. There's single-parent families.
Right.
There's different situations for everybody. So I'm not going to suggest what age they should be giving their kids a device like that, but you know how responsible the kid is also varies, you know. So I mean, there's a lot of variables that go into that decision. The only thing I would urge parents not to do is let their kids hold the phone up to their ear for hours at a time. It's you know, the studies are somewhat inconclusive about the health issues associated
with brain cancer,
cellular radios.
Yeah.
But I still would err on the side of caution and not have, especially a child whose brain is still developing, to not have a smartphone up against their ear. But most kids are not talking, they're texting.
Exactly.
But they are, you know, it's just as dangerous to text while you're crossing the street, you know, when you're not looking.
Oh, for sure.
Than it is to talk on the phone with the radiation concerns. So, you know, so I would have to say that definitely, you know, to answer your question in a little bit more of a concise manner, I think that with kids, we're seeing a lot of technology for entertainment's sake. So they're going to YouTube instead of watching traditional TV, that on-demand generation.
Right.
They're playing games on mobile devices like iPod Touches, and to a lesser extent these days, the Nintendos and the portable Sony gaming systems, the Vita. More kids are you know, gravitating to iPod Touches, smart iPhones, iPads.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely for entertainment's sake, because you know, at that age, even though they're starting to do homework, you know, they don't need to rely on smartphones and tablets for that. They should have a home computer with a physical keyboard, which is more conducive for typing and research on the web. But definitely, what I've seen change over the last few years for kids is technology is enabling kids to have access to their favorite movies, TV shows, and music, and ebooks wherever they are because of portable digital devices.
And I mean, I don't know about you, but I see in my practice and hear about just personally and professionally, children very, very young getting smartphones, as you said, like, you know, maybe even like 8, 9.
Or even younger, yeah. I mean, again, every situation is different.
Right.
But and so the parents have to, in the end, make the call. Nothing is going to replace parenting.
Exactly.
But if it gives parents peace of mind to know that kids have a BlackBerry or an iPhone or an Android device or a Windows phone in their backpack, in case, you know, if they walk home from school, they want that peace of mind, then, you know, I get that.
But also,
kids obviously can't pull that out during the class. They should also be not socializing with kids solely over Facebook or, you know, or a game like Minecraft. They have to socialize in person and learn how to look at someone in the eye and play with someone for real.
Right.
And if you want to complement that with online socializing through Twitter or Facebook or gaming, then fine. But I push this on my kids as much as possible because, you know, with my job, getting all these gadgets sent to me daily, my fear is that they're going to be so reliant on tech that there's other associated issues like, you know, the social part that I just mentioned or obesity. And like, you know, I want my kids to be active. I want them to have fun. I want them to be social. And the tech should be there too. That's going to be a very important part of their lives, more so than you and I, but it's got to be in check. You know, it can't be too much of, too much tech.
And it makes perfect sense to me that you'd be more vigilant about that because you know the pros and cons.
I do, but again, like you mentioned, it's tough with what I do.
Yeah.
As you know, it's like Christmas every day when they come home from school, and I often let them open up the packages that I get in the mail of products to review.
Right.
And, you know, they love it. But they recognize that it's like, this isn't normal. Like most people's jobs are, it's not like this, but I do work from home.
Yeah.
I do review video games and gadgets. So some kids would say I have a dream job. That's great.
Yeah.
I do like it, but just because I get it doesn't mean A, it's theirs. That's another issue, you know, about them being spoiled. And B, it doesn't mean that they, should be spending all their time on it.
I'm impressed.
I point to the trampoline in the backyard and I say, go jump on it for a while.
Right.
Go call a friend and have a play date, like in person.
Right.
Not just over the internet.
And do you model what you hope to see in them too?
Yeah, I do. I feel like I do. As someone who's so plugged in, I know when to turn it off. My friends actually tease me because at the dinner table, like at a restaurant, I'm not checking in where I am at a restaurant, and I'm not tweeting every thought that pops into my head. I think I'm pretty good at being a role model for someone who needs to balance. And it's tough because I work for myself.
Right.
I'm fortunately very busy.
Right.
And, you know, it's great that I've got a lot of writing opportunities. And so it's easy to fall into that tech trap and be all consumed by it. But I purposely turn it off. People will say to me the next day, hey, I texted you last night. Why didn't you write back? Or didn't you see my comment on Facebook? And I'm like, oh, sorry.
Yes.
Because I really believe that you need, like, I was reluctant to be on Twitter. I know you're a big fan, Sarah, of Twitter. And I was late. I only joined last year, 2012, because, you know, it was one more thing I didn't want to sort of layer on top of my daily responsibilities.
Yeah. Although, having said that, I mean, I do like Twitter as a way of sharing what I'm doing with people.
But like
yourself, I don't go on just to talk about. In fact, I purposely don't go on to talk about where I am. You know, I'm not using it as a social thing. I'm using it strictly for professional reasons.
I understand. Yeah, and myself as well. My friends, I don't even like when they check me in.
Yeah.
You know, I don't see the need to broadcast to the world where you are. If you do that, if you're listening to this podcast and that's your thing, that's fine. A lot of my friends do it.
Well, actually,
they're not even techie. They just love sharing that information. Part of it is privacy. Part of it is, you know, do I want to broadcast that my house is empty kind of thing?
But absolutely.
The other part of it is just, it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
And I'm just, I like unplugging and I like, you know, I like my downtime.
I think the privacy thing is a huge thing. I have a huge issue when people, you know, put a picture of me or a picture of me with them on Facebook. I just think, you know, there should be some code around checking in with the person.
Like permission.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of it is common sense. They should be asking.
But the world that we live in, I mean, my 13-year-old will be the first to tell me that, Mom, we don't live in a private world anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody tells everybody what's going on. I mean, there's very little respect, it seems, for privacy. I think that's one of the worst parts of, for better or worse.
And I think that's, you know, this is a problem I think a lot of parents have who are not tech savvy, because they're expected as parents, and rightfully so, to educate their kids about life, about staying safe.
Mm-hmm.
So they know all, you know, it's easy for parents to remind their kids that you don't talk to strangers and somebody pulls up in a car, you know, like that, like the street smarts part of it.
Right.
But now we have a generation of kids who are far more comfortable with technology than their parents are. So a lot of parents feel helpless. How can they possibly protect their children when they understand this world better than they do?
And how can they?
Yeah, and you know, and I've often written about this. I often refer to it as the digital divide. There's sort of two interpretations. implications of digital divide. It's between the tech savvy and those who are not, like parents and their kids. But it also refers to a socioeconomic divide between accessibility to technology and those who don't have it, and how far behind they can fall without having the means to use technology. But I'm referring to it in the former, where, you know, the kids are so much more comfortable and fluent in technology than their parents are. I've often said that kids are they're digital natives. They grew up in this world, and they're completely versed and comfortable in all things technology. They don't even see it as technology. It's just life.
It's a language.
Our generation, Sarah, we're digital immigrants. We had to learn and adapt to technology and understand its language and its nuances and its protocols and its netiquette. And learn it. Now, so I've tried to, as a journalist and as a TV and radio show host, I found my niche a few years ago, which is serving as a middleman, a translator, if you will. Someone who, I always say, I like to break down geek speak into street speak.
That's nice.
Because I think there needs to be a liaison between these two worlds. And that's where I try to, you know, that's my audience, are those who are, they like technology, they're consumers of it, but they just need a little bit of help in understanding it.
So where can parents read more about that in terms of?
Sure. So, I mean, I write for a number of, I would call, mainstream publications, like Toronto Star, USA Today, as well as like web portals like The Loop, formerly Simpatico. I write for MSN, Yahoo.
So, but do you have a site where you post some of these articles on as well?
Yeah, all these sites. So if they search for my name, they would see, you know, all the articles and blog posts that I contribute to these other sites. I don't host my own website, because it would be a bit of a conflict of interest as a freelance journalist, because I would
have
to sell advertising on it to you know, to support it. And because that could be perceived as a conflict of interest, I'd rather just write for other people at this stage in my game.
Right.
And link usually through social media as well. On Facebook and on Twitter, I'll link to articles that I wrote and blog posts that I like to point people to. Or maybe if I'm on TV and there's an interview coming up, I'll say, hey, if you're around in an hour, turn on such and such station.
Right. We talked about children and children being very young in terms of, you know, being given smartphones or as you said, just even being raised, understanding and being so comfortable with the knowledge and the language. What anything in terms of what adults or teens particularly gravitate towards? Is it more of the same?
So kids focus, as I mentioned earlier, I think very heavily on entertainment, and that makes sense. Teens, I would say, are focused a little bit heavier on communication.
Right.
They're socializing. So that could be Facebook, Twitter, texting, BBMing, on BlackBerry, iMessaging, you know, so emailing, ways of staying in touch with their friends, even video calling and sharing media. Yet that entertainment element is still there as well, such as music and video and gaming. Then when you get to the next stage in your life, when you enter the workforce, and then I think there's a shift towards productivity and efficiency and organization. For example, I'm a big fan of Siri, which is a feature in the latest iPhones and iPads that let you talk to your device in a human-like voice, and you hear a human-like voice back.
Right.
So I talk to Siri probably hourly. It's a female voice, if you haven't heard it, in Canada anyway.
Yeah, I've heard it.
And it helps me stay productive. So I can say, Siri, when I get home, remind me to call, you know, such and such editor.
It's like having a personal secretary.
Yeah, it's basically a personal assistant that you don't have to put on your payroll.
Yeah.
So when I pull into my driveway, Siri will say, Mark, don't forget to call blah, blah, blah.
That's amazing.
So I rely on that. That's just one small example of what Siri does. But she manages my calendar. She like pulls up information that I need. I can ask for facts. I can ask for, you know, give me an 18% tip on $310 for four people.
Wow.
You know, I mean, it's amazing.
That's incredible.
That's another trend that we've seen, I should probably mention, over the years, is how we interface with technology has evolved, where it's a lot easier now to interface instead of using a mouse and a keyboard or complicated commands and drop-down menus. Now it's through touch, through smartphones and tablets, and also now on laptops and desktops, as well as voice and even gestures in the air, you know, depending on the device.
Wow.
So we're starting to find a more natural, more human-like way to interface with information. And that the AI, the artificial intelligence of these computers, it's going to only get better and better. So like in Star Trek, while it's maybe like science fiction, the ability to talk to the computer and hear a very human-like voice back and someone you can interact with, that's coming, you know, and it's coming sooner than we think. So that's one of the cool things about technology, is that the way we're interfacing is evolving and it's becoming a lot easier and more natural.
I mean, you hear talk of people, it's like, you know, when you speed dial, if you program the numbers and you never have to dial them yourself, you don't memorize the numbers. Do you have any concerns about that in terms of people becoming overly reliant on artificial intelligence?
It's a good point. And I just gave the example with Siri, how she can calculate a tip for me.
Right.
But I still take pride in when I'm depositing checks in my bank, that I don't use a calculator to add up all my checks. So I might sound like a hypocrite.
No, but then you're an immigrant, as you said. I wonder how children...
No, I do. There was a concern about this with calculators a few years ago.
Yeah.
You know, where, you know, our kids going to not know how to add, subtract, divide, and multiply because they can just pull out their calculator. And the smartphones are obviously can do quite a bit more than just an average calculator that you can buy at the dollar store.
Right. And having said that, I mean, it's just the way of the future and the present, I guess. Really, why do we need calculators if we have this? I mean, we just have to, I guess it's a way of just accepting change and embracing what it offers us.
Yes and no. I mean, I agree that if we have these tools available, why not take advantage of them, and we can use our brains for something else. But we don't want to become a dumb society because
right.
our devices are thinking for us.
True.
There is something to be said for adding up all, you know, the numbers that you need or...
True.
Coming out with a tip for, you know, I'm just using math as an example, but
the robots may just take over.
Yeah, and soon, who knows? We'll have like you know, Google glasses, so we don't even need the smartphone. We'll just be seeing augmented reality on top of the real world.
Oh, we'll just think. We'll just think about
in our brains.
Yeah, we'll just
We'll be in 100 years from now. We'll be what 20% or 25% machine. Anyways, you know. So
I know.
Who knows where that line is, and how much it's going to do the heavy lifting for us? Whether it's long term memory, short term memory, mathematics, spelling.
Yeah.
You know, we never had spell check on a typewriter, right?
Yeah.
So, but kids today are getting used to spell check. But if they can learn from it, if they can see what their tablet or smartphone or computer is underlining,
right.
and they can see what that, that's I'm okay with that. But you see some of this texting language, and I don't even know what it is.
I know. But, and do you think there's a gender difference? Do you think that boys or men are more drawn to technology or technological gadgets than women? Do you see a gender?
So I've recently done quite a bit of work in this area and have found through many studies and reports that women are increasingly interested in adopters of technology. And in some cases, they're out buying technology more than men. They're becoming more of a purchasing powerhouse, not to mention an influencer in the house for other members of the family, more than ever before. So it's almost 50-50 for, so again, some studies suggest that men, depending on the area, they still gravitate to, you know, they still embrace technology in greater numbers than women. But other studies I've found is that women are, depending on the technology, becoming a major player. For example, some studies out of the States from 2012 and 2011 suggest that women are more interested in smartphones, tablets, and laptops, but men are more interested in TVs and audio gear than women.
Hmm.
And interestingly, yeah, it was TVs, it was audio gear, and there was one other tech category that had more men interested than women. And I sort of had this realization that the technology that was interesting, more interesting or more appealing to women, it was more interactive. Mm-hmm. Or TVs and at this point in time,
yeah.
And music is more of a one-way passive experience.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
You know, you're it's being broadcasted to you, and you're
right.
It's passive enjoyment.
Right, right.
Where women were more interested in interactive
right.
technology, not passive.
Right.
So I found that interesting, that tablets and smartphones and laptops were more were more appealing to women than men on average. So kind of interesting there. I don't know if I'm making something nothing.
No.
But, you know, so, and when it comes to video games, 34% of gamers are women. So still, you know, it's still primarily a male thing.
Yeah.
But it's changing. It depends on the type of game. More women play games on Facebook than men.
Yeah.
Almost as many women play mobile games as men. So, mm-hmm. like the Angry Birds and the, you know, the Words with Friends and the Draw Somethings and the Temple Run, the games that you play on a smartphone or tablet,
yeah.
almost as many women are playing as men. More women are playing Facebook games than men. But if you look at console games, the ones where you're playing with a joystick or a controller in your hand in front of your TV, that's primarily a boys-only club still.
Do you think
that's changing?
Do you think that there's a relationship between violent video games and violent behavior, especially?
That's a tough one, and we could have a whole
podcast
just on that, Sarah,
yeah.
and not even scratch the surface of that. The age-old argument is that, you know, does violent media breed violent behavior, or is it the other way around? Do people who have a tendency towards violence appreciate and enjoy
yeah.
that type of media more? And I mean, I know as a psychologist, you could have a field day with that, that question. Let's just say that if you are a rational person that can distinguish the difference between real life and fantasy, the latter being video games,
right.
then, you know, there's no correlation between
yeah.
playing violent video games and acting out violently. If a 16-year-old is going to play Call of Duty and shoot people in the head in the video game in this war simulation, they have found, and I'm saying they because there have been hundreds if not thousands of studies around the world over the past 20 years, that children are I'd say 16, but the kids are not any more likely to act out violently when they go outside of when they leave the game and they go in the real world, that they recognize and distinguish the fact that one is fantasy and one is reality. There's been those old arguments. There's been violence. You know, most of the mass murders have taken place, in the first half of the 20th century when there were no video games.
Right.
So, all the atrocities and everything. I mean, there's that argument as well. I'm not defending violent video games. I think that, as a parent of three young kids, I do choose as a parent what they can play and what they can't, in part with the ESRB ratings on in the corner of every box, M for mature, for 17 and older, T for teen, 13 and older, E10 plus for 10 and older, and E for 6 and older. I pretty much go by those, but on the back of every video game, SAR, it'll tell you why that game got the rating. And if you go online to the ESRB website, again, that stands for Entertainment Software Rating Board, it will give you examples from the game as to why that game got that particular rating.
You can choose
as a parent or guardian what you deem as appropriate or inappropriate in your household.
Right.
Maybe you're very lax when it comes to profanity.
Right.
But and sexuality. Maybe you're completely fine with, your kids being exposed to different sexual innuendos or even sexual imagery.
Right.
But you're dead set against violence.
Right.
You can choose what is relevant to you.
And you find that those ratings are pretty reliable? Because I find sometimes movies, for example, are not always reliable for me as a parent.
Yeah, for the most part, I find it reliable. There are also third-party resources you can go to other than the ESRB. For example, I write for one called commonsensemedia.org, and I actually play through the games, and I write extensive you know, reviews, not just of the game's content, but any content that parents should be aware of. There's sections on violence, and that includes blood and gore. There's on profanity, on even things like how are women portrayed in the game? How are people of color portrayed in the game? What kind of consumerization is in the game? Is there a lot of advertisements? And, you know, so we dig quite deep.
That's great.
To flag any potential issues with anyone. And I would argue we go a bit deeper than the ESRB. So yeah, there are other resources out there. But start with the letter grade on the box.
Right.
Understand your kids. You know, if they, if you feel that they're becoming desensitized to that kind of to you know, violence,
yeah,
because they're playing a violent video game, that's not a good thing as well, but it's a hard thing to gauge as well. So
yeah, and again, what you're modeling, because if you're playing that as an adult, your brain may be more sophisticated, you may know the difference between reality,
right,
but still it's hard to just, you know, to be playing that all the time and telling your kids don't look.
This isn't for you.
Right.
No, as someone who reviews video games, I wait until my kids go to sleep whenever I'm going to review those kinds of games. Because naturally, especially my oldest son, he's like, ooh.
Yeah.
Like, he'll see it in the box.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, oh, I'd love to play this, Dad. And he gets mad at me because his friends are allowed to play Call of Duty.
Yeah.
But I don't let him play Call of Duty. He's only 10.
Yeah.
You're supposed to be 17 or older. Now, that doesn't mean I'm going to wait till he's 17. I probably won't.
Yeah.
But, his friends are allowed to play that already. So
well, you know, you're probably...
I draw the line as well with, you know, if... Okay, I might let him play one of those shooting games,
yeah,
but how... If it's really a fantasy, like if he's in space or is he shooting aliens and
right,
is there blood, then I'm a little bit more likely to allow him to play it if it's less realistic. But
right,
if he's going to shoot, you know, police officers or
right,
drive over pedestrians, I'm not going to allow that.
It's funny. I think you and I are in a similar boat in that, you know, my kids don't always like the way that I parent them, but at least I have my experience and skills to back me up.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with you. You know, you could probably, even though your kids may want to be like their other friends, they at least know somewhere in the back of their mind that you're doing this because you know better.
Yeah, I hope so. They probably don't realize it at their age now. And, you know, I'm pretty liberal. I hope they recognize that. And thanks, you know, I mean, I agree that I don't know if they recognize that or appreciate that at their age
probably
now.
Not
but
yet.
Hopefully in the long run, I mean, our job is to just make sure that they're the best possible people they can be.
Absolutely.
But I'm pretty liberal. I mean, in some other areas, like I let them watch movies that... you know, I enjoy it at their age, and you know, sometimes
right,
halfway through it, I'm like, oh wow, that's. But I think it turned out okay.
Exactly, I think so too. So in terms of better or worse, you know, obviously we know that technology has enhanced our lives in so many ways. Just even about it, you know, having personal assistants is certainly one of them, and being able to communicate, I mean, it still blows my mind how I can get information when I was a kid, I had to go and look for, you know, which encyclopedia I would take off the shelf to get something, and how limited that knowledge was, and how, you know, quickly it was so like current only for a short period of time. So we know for sure how incredibly, you know, valuable it is and how enriched our lives and our children's lives are. But what about we've certainly talked about some of the concerns that parents should have. Anything else that comes to you? I know recently I wrote an article about the addictive nature of electronics.
So as I mentioned earlier, Sarah, I am a firm believer in moderation.
Right.
That you can't be, you know, like anything, technology can't just be your whole life.
Right.
So while kids, and there is a bit of an addictive element to it, especially with video games, because, you know, there's that dangling carrot. You want to finish the level and see what's next, and
right,
it keeps you glued. And
right,
that's the role of the game designer, is to keep you glued in that world. You know, but, you know, it's up to the parent to make sure that the kids are not playing games 24/7. We also have a rule at our place about no texting at the table.
Right.
You know, and they complain about it, but when we're having dinner, we we talk about what we did that day as a family, and you know.
So do they actually have?
I know that they would rather have their Minecraft open. Minecraft is an incredibly popular computer game that my boys are really into, and they would rather be eating their dinner while they're playing Minecraft because they're playing online with other people.
Right.
And they feel like they're letting down their friends because they're pulling out of this game. But you know, especially because of what I do for a living, I'm very sensitive to that, and I think parents should have some limits. So we've got rules, we've got, you know, hourly times, you know, and sometimes technology can even aid in that. I mean, there are a lot of computer game consoles that parents can set a, you know, it's a password-protected sort of area of the console that lets you select how long kids can play, not mm-hmm. just what games they can play in terms of content, but they can also help them, like it'll turn off the machine with like a 10-minute and then a 5-minute warning.
Right.
So if they're not always around, and you know, I'm fortunate that I work from home, so I can be a little bit more hands-on in you know, the enforcing of these rules. But for those parents who, you know, dual-income families or single-parent families, there are some technology tools that can help them help, you know, at least help with monitoring all this.
Yeah, and it's, and as you said, it's partly the video games, but it's also just, as you said, setting very clear limits in regards
right.
to things
a lot
like
of parents can't turn off, like the whole
oh,
BlackBerry,
for sure.
CrackBerry. You know, they call it the CrackBerry if you remember.
Yeah,
because you know these were people who, whenever they felt their phone vibrate or heard a chime or saw that blinking red light, they
right.
had to know who wrote them.
Well, I'm one of them. I mean, it's as a parent, I know how addictive it can be.
Right, right. So, you know, it's easy again. As we can, it's actions speak louder than words. If parents are seeing, if kids are seeing their parents who can't put down these phones, they think, well, then why can't I?
Right.
So, you know.
Sitting,
I'm not a parenting expert like yourself.
Well, but it sounds like you've got a pretty good handle on it. I mean, as you said, like not just setting limits for your kids, but setting limits for a family. So one of the things that we did recently was we had a 40-hour hiatus from all things technological.
Right.
Just as a return to simple things like playing board games and
right.
hanging out together. And it was really, it was quite profound just in terms of how much more productive we were. Because one of the things that I find that's most disconcerting is as how you can get so sucked into it and how time just passes by so quickly
yep.
and how things just don't get done.
I hear you.
So anything else that I've missed, anything that you think would be important to share in terms of, for better or worse, how technology has changed families' lives, anything that you could recommend as a bottom line for families in terms of, you know, monitoring?
No, I mean, I guess I would just say that there are a lot of parents who are very overwhelmed and intimidated by technology. And, you know, in some cases, frankly, they're scared of it.
Yeah.
But this is very much a part of Canadian life now, and especially with younger generations. You know, the younger generation, you can't ask them to not be on social media because that's where they're congregating. You know, they would be an outcast if they weren't. So the answer isn't to ban them, but it's, you know, it's about moderation. It's about parenting in the 21st century. It's about understanding a little bit about what they're doing and trying to instill some core morals and, you know, ethics that, you know, that they can carry with them throughout their lives. And, you know, I've often written about ways to childproof the internet as best you can. There's nothing 100%, you know, but everything from keeping the computer in a central area of the home instead of letting them do whatever they're doing in their bedroom on the laptop,
right.
To, you know, software you can install that can filter and monitor what they're doing, to, you know, making it a family activity, not such a solitary one,
and I guess
having an open communication with your kids about what they're doing online, who they're talking to, and making sure they understand the dangers of you know, bullying, and there's bullying issues, there's predatory issues. I mean, there's a lot of problems. So as long as that you make your kid
savvy.
You know, street smart.
Right.
Mind street smart. You know, I mean, so there's moderation, there's tools to help you protect your children. It's very easy to feel overwhelmed by technology, but you can't throw up your hands and say, well, I don't understand it, so I don't want to be a part of it, and I don't want my kids to be part of it either. That's just not
yeah.
realistic.
Right.
So you know, you could just do the best you can do. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's still all about those core values and, you know, and instilling those on your kids and having an open dialogue about what they're experiencing. And you still can play a vital role without having to have a computer engineering degree to understand it all.
Well, thank you, Mark. Thank you for your time and your expertise on such an important topic.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I hope the chat was okay, Sarah, if that's what you had in mind.
Oh, for sure. And
thanks. And
I also wanted to say thanks to all of you for listening to For Better or Worse, How Today's Technology Has Changed Families' Lives. And to see a full listing of all Help Me Sarah podcasts, please visit the podcast section at www.helpmesarah.com. You can also subscribe to Help Me Sarah podcasts on iTunes, subscribe to my Facebook page, which is Sarah Dimmerman Help Me Sarah, or follow me on Twitter at Help Me Sarah. Until next time.